Way up in Harlem at a table for two. There was four of us, me, your big feet, and you.
Welcome back to Glad Traveling. Again this week, we have Tim Gordon with us. Glad to be back. What do you have to say about Chapter 5? That was your chapter on family and economy. How would you say that we're this crypto-Catholic nation as far as American life, culture, politics, and philosophy, as far as family and economy is concerned?
Well, we were. We stopped being a Catholic nation in the sexual revolution when,
okay,
not to put too fine a point on it, mothers went to work. That really, you know, there's a whole litany of papal encyclicals basically directly condemning that idea. Even Quadragesimo Anno, which,
you know, is that California accent. That's what I was hoping for. Anno.
Anno.
Yeah, like Keanu Reeves is schooling me on politics here. This is sweet.
Yeah. Like, hopefully I can ennoble Keanu Reeves' impression in people's minds.
That's the other reason I love listening to you and Taylor. You have, like, both the two of the deepest voices, and I was like, can I interview these guys in some, like, an octave higher? And you guys are these basses that just boom against each other. It's pretty sweet listening to y'all.
Quadragesimo Anno. Yeah, but I mean, so that's the other main point outside of integralism, monarchism, that I think the so-called trads get mixed up on. It's kind of related, is why free enterprise has been time and again in all of these social encyclicals lauded by popes. You know, Pius XI says there is nothing wrong with capitalism. There is everything wrong in say with socialism. Of course, capitalism is just, as I always say, a reflecting glass of the endemic morals of the people. And since we have basically an immoral popular culture now, our capitalism looks really bad. Capitalism is not a crystal ball. No political economy is. Political economy itself is just a reflecting glass. So now when people look and they see smut and 50% divorce, both of which accrue to, you know, women getting into the workforce and leaving home and all that, sexual revolution stuff and contraception and abortion, that's part of the economy, yes, but that's just because the citizens are bad. They're bad people too much of the time. That's not the economy's fault. The economy actually is the only political economy, free enterprise, of the options, which reflects the you know, freedom of will and the subsidiarity required by the Catholic intellectual tradition. So yes, there's smut, yes, there's things we don't like in our economy, but except it comes down to whether or not we believe in subsidiarity. Does the government have the power? And it would take quite a muscular arm, a long arm of the state, to tell you that you cannot, I don't know, drink a soda bigger than 32 ounces if you're in New York. Is that good? No, it's not good to be drinking lots of soda, but your father either inculcates the habit in you of not doing so or not.
Mm-hmm.
Government doesn't have the power. That's all economy is about. It's about households functioning properly. And for that, and that's the connection. Yeah. Aristotle called his politics on the family economy. If the family economy is not working properly, then, you know, and how can it, if both parents are at work until 6 p.m., right, then yeah, you're going to get kids that are on the Internet, on iPhones, buying bad things, consuming bad things. Careerism fuels consumerism, but neither of those, careerism on the supply side and consumerism on the demand side, are the fault of capitalism. They're the fault of the scummy people.
And, you know, just a note on Marxism, you know, of course the church allows moms to go to work if this is necessary for economic reasons, but at the very heart of Marxism is these two points you mentioned, women going back to work and forming the workforce, moms entering the workforce, and the sexual revolution. These weren't just ancillary parts of Marxism. These were central parts. Anyone who studied the history of Poland the past 100 years knows that those were two very central parts to what the Russians tried to foist upon the Polish people.
That's right. I'd say those are the two parts that, you know, are the beating heart of Marxism. People just want to talk, Americans generally just want to talk economics and condemn Marxism. Yeah, I agree, but here's why. The more important part is the destruction of the family, And right. The clear, easy way to destroy the family is to tell mothers to contracept, get on the pill, and you know, you need to do that if you're going to work.
Yeah.
Working, sure, of course it's fine for widows and people like that. Obviously, someone has to earn the bread. That's just a surrogate function of the father. But that's not what we have in our society, and no one wants to talk about it. Yeah, I'm your Huckleberry, I'll talk about it. People are, you know, working two incomes. It's even Elizabeth Warren, the Democrat, said it's a two-income trap. They're doing so they can have a fourth TV, a second luxury car. It's not even like a second jalopy. All these families that are earning two middling incomes, they earn better income than traditional people like me, even if someone like me makes a decent single-man paycheck, because they're stacking together two middling incomes, and so they're both driving around Mercedes, and that's what they're trading in the rearing and the educating of the kids for.
That's right, and the kids are not raised by them. They're raised by either daycare or a nanny or a manny, whatever.
Right, right, absolutely.
That reminds me of go ahead, keep going. Yeah, I like what you're saying.
I was just going to say, so closing thought on the political economy.
Yeah.
I mean, the poor are materialistic as often or more often than the rich. I don't agree with Pope Francis on that. When I think of what's evil with capitalism is two income households.
I like what you texted me earlier about how you're Thomas who likes Dostoevsky, and I remember learning that in Brothers Karamazov. One of those chapters, he starts with this notion that selfishness affects the rich and poor in different ways, but he doesn't let the poor off the hook because he shows that they're striving for money. Remember, Dostoevsky, he had such a fascinating CV because he went all the way from being spiritual director to the czar to, I think he was in like some gulag as he was standing up against communism. So he saw where everything was going with Marxism, and he understood very well that horizoning the poor on this absolute economic view of everything about them has to be seen through the eyes of the economy is going to totally ruin them. He was absolutely right.
Right, right. He also had the amazing insight that socialism is the love for man in general and the hatred for man in particular.
Yes, I love that.
See, yep. People that listen to me talk and then meet me tend to say to me, essentially, that I'm the opposite of. Sometimes I'll condemn entire generations, classes, people, whatever. It's like, but this is what the Christian is following Dostoevsky's reasoning.
Yeah.
It's a hatred for man in general and a love for him in particular. If socialism is the opposite, and
I've seen that in the priesthood too. That, you know, it's very easy to stand at the pulpit and just give pious platitudes and tell people that you love them, but are you willing to actually spend hours counseling someone who's very broken? That's where the rubber meets the road. It isn't telling people you love them from the pulpit and then just scampering back to your rectory and playing video games. You know, the rubber meets the road if you meet a prostitute on the road and give her a miraculous medal and just listen to her story, you know? And I think that that's one thing that a lot of people, this isn't just projecting my life upon these other priests out there, but there's a lot of good conservative neoconservative Novus Ordo priests and traditional priests out there who, you know, they're slammed for being not pastoral, but then you look at their pastoral practice and it's like, they're the only dudes showing up to hospitals at 2 a.m. for anointing when all these baby boomers who are getting them sent to the hinterlands are the ones saying they're not pastoral. Well, and a lot of those baby, you know, some of those liberal baby boomers are very generous in getting to the hospital at 2 a.m. too. I don't mean that it's a direct split down the middle. But we're certainly misrepresented to say, well, just because we're traditional on quoting St. Thomas Aquinas, doesn't mean we're going to refrain from a hospital call at 2 a.m. And I think that, the reason we have this delineation in the modern mind is precisely because we've been taught by Marxist culture, even slipping into the United States, that we're supposed to kind of love humanity. And for some reason, the people who love humanity are going to love humans. No, it doesn't work that way. It's usually the people who talk about how wonderful humanity is that are really, really rotten to individuals.
Yeah, go to Santa Monica. You know, it's People's Republic of Santa Monica. You got rent control, all these socialist measures. You got poor on every corner. And
yeah.
saying about MLK Boulevard. It's always the most violent street in every city.
Right,
all the
weird
most liberal cities have the most homeless. Yeah, give me any day of the week. Give me Dirty Harry, you know, who I think he claimed he's racist even against white people, but he likes everybody one-on-one. Or give me Gran Torino, you know, a really beautiful movie about it. It expresses really well what I'm saying about Dostoevsky and the opposite of his definition of socialism. He just likes people one-on-one, but kind of hate all the classes out there, all the classes, all the distinctions, all these categories. What I'm talking about is instantiating the opposite of identity politics. It's okay to do, because people will joke me on TNT, you know, I'll just begin a sentence, oh, I hate all these blanks, you know, and it's not usually, it's, I don't think ever been race, but it's just a broad swath of people. And I'm like, obviously I don't mean everyone, but I do hate the categories. Individuals are whom we're called to love.
You know, and to my litmus test, if I'll watch a movie or not, is if it takes Our Lord's name in vain. I look at Focus on the Family, Plugged In. If it takes the Holy Name of Jesus, if it misuses the name of Jesus, I won't watch it. And so I'm ashamed that I kind of cracked on my resolution with Gran Torino. But I'll say this, that if it weren't for the misuse of the Holy Name of Jesus in that movie, I would say it's one of my top three movies. So I would hate to promote it to my listeners precisely because I don't want to promote any sins against the Second Commandment. But we'll give a little overview of that movie that I agree 100% with you. He's so amazing in that movie because he uses these racist terms, but really when the rubber meets the road, this man's willing to give his life for individuals of the very races that he uses mocking terms for. In some sense, he's almost this Christ figure, spoiler alert here, that he dies for his neighbors of a different race, even though he uses racially derogatory terms. That's a great example of Dostoevsky being lived out today.
Right, which isn't like a fairy tale. What I'm trying to return, what I would, if I could, is return the world to believing what they already know anyway. And people all know, I mean, sticks and stones will break my bones, but words don't really hurt anyone. It's the opposite of the narrative by the socialists who run the two halves of popular, the popular intelligentsia or the pseudo-intelligentsia, which is the modern university in America, and then TV. They're telling you the exact opposites, that words can actually hurt someone or whatever. But we know in our own generation and generations past, military guys, the real heroes, you know, like Marcus Luttrell, Chris Kyle, guys like those. I mean, they don't talk like, I agree with you, you know, say the F word before you say, take the Lord's name in vain. One's really, really serious. I never take the Lord's name in vain either. I've habituated it. But these guys swear like sailors, and of course they're funny, and I dare I say fun names for all classes of things. I'm not talking about race or whatever, but these are the warriors that'll go to battle to defend their neighbor,
at their side, where the liberals, they victimize races so as to use them. That's what's so annoying about the left, is they really don't actually care. I mean, the proof of this is how Planned Parenthood always plants their Planned Parenthoods in black and Hispanic neighborhoods. They know what they're doing. Hillary Clinton...
All Planned Parenthood is to destroy the blacks and the Mexicans. They're just really crafty with the language.
Exactly.
And anybody's listening to us right now thinking, oh, this is, you know, this is beyond the pale. It's like, no, just trust your common sense. It's remember when Cardinal Casper got caught by Edward Penton talking about Blessed Cardinal Sarah, lowercase b, and he said, oh, well, you know, you don't have to listen to Sarah. He's just an African.
That's
a very leftist thing to say. I mean, remember, leftists,
it always comes out with them.
Yeah, always. They're always on the side of identity politics. They want to keep racism alive and well. They just want to keep it in politically correct terms, which enables them to decide what's licit and what's illicit. But most people that would actually die for someone talk a lot more like Dirty Harry or Clint Eastwood's character in Gran Torino.
Yeah, and everybody, what's the name of the founder of Planned Parenthood? I just blanked out on her name.
Sanger, Margaret Sanger.
Yeah, Margaret Sanger. So everybody knows how racist she was, but the people think, well, but she's disconnected from the modern Planned Parenthood. Well, no, Hillary Clinton was given the Margaret Sanger Award, the woman who said that she, quote, wanted to eradicate all blacks, Slavs, and Jews. That was the order she gave, blacks, Slavs, and Jews. And then Hillary Clinton gets an award in honor of her, and the media just turns a blind eye to that.
Yeah, you can't write this stuff.
No, absolutely not. Well, Tim, I just want to close this one quote. I really like this in Chapter 0 in your preface here. Quote, the concept of church reminds us that our connection to the supernatural remains natural. A republic simply cannot be populated by fully humane citizens, each recognized as persons, without the daily role of sacramental grace. In turn, this is why the Prot and Light separation between church and state America has proven so disastrous. The natural law insinuates that the unique role of mankind, the only intelligent members of the universe with souls to be nurtured, cannot be honored when church is ostracized by the state. And then you explain how Chapter 4 explains all that. And, you know, I really like just what you put in there, that there's a connection between the natural and the supernatural. And I would say only Catholicism can do that, not only because of the sacraments, but because we believe that Christ is a divine person who's fully human, and that at the ascension, he actually raised all of our humanity to be in the presence, and at least anyone who's been baptized, to the presence of the Blessed Trinity. I think a lot of times in Catholicism, we see the right as having the sacraments and the left as talking about community. But I like this paragraph of yours because it really shows that these two actually have to remain in union, not exactly like the hypostatic union, but not unlike the hypostatic union. So I just want to see, do you have any like thoughts on just like family being the center, a Catholic community of a parish being the center of this to really be the genesis of this restoration or renewal of our country if we stand any chance at all?
Yeah, that's a great thought, a more abstract thought. But one thing that I think gives it teeth, concretizes it a bit,
yeah,
is kind of a critique of our perverted version of capitalism, is that privacy is good, but Tocqueville warned that too much privacy would yield the kind of life I think too many people are leading out in the suburbs. Obviously, this is not an advertisement for the kind of lives people are leading in the city, hipsters,
sure,
or whatnot.
Sure.
But it's like you go to work, you're slaving to get your third car or your eighth TV or whatever. And you come home and you have the automatic garage door and it shuts and you never even, you're like in a metal box from door to door. You never even see your neighbor. Again, this isn't the fault of capitalism. I'd robustly say it's not. But what our version of it in 2019, American suburban capitalism, is no one interacts with their neighbors. I mean, a lot of people don't know what their neighbors look like. There's no sense of community whatsoever. We're all displayed. The problem is we need to be around other Catholics. So you don't really know what your actual neighborhood neighbors are,
yeah,
by way of what sect of Christianity, if any. But it's like we need to be around our families more often, and too many people, treat their profession as a kind of surrogate for their vocation. Your vocation as a male is, unless you're a priest, is to be a father and a husband. That means you need to have boots on the ground. You need to spend as much time as you can around the wife and kid, relaxing, not too many activities, all that. That's how you develop community within the home.
That's right.
Likewise, you should be somewhat tied to your neighborhood, right? And it's really hard to do,
yeah,
with this model of door to door, you're in a car and then you shut your garage door and then you,
yeah,
just go to bed at 7:30 p.m. I mean, I've never been might be my private bias. I'm not an early to bed guy. Got people go to bed at 7:30 p.m. and you get up the next day, you do it again. I'm not defending that form of capitalism. I'm saying that is the worst form of capitalism and the least subsidiarian and the least church driven, sacrament driven form of capitalism.
That's right. I remember reading in National Geographic, NASA says there's a 12% chance that a solar flare will knock out the grid, the whole electronic and technological grid. And I often think, wow, that's about the best thing that we could have happen to get rid of everyone's little porn pocket machines and everything and actually get them to know their neighbors and, maybe reduce this online tribalism where people only have friends online instead of in real life. I don't have a solution besides a solar flare knocking this stuff out. but maybe bringing bundt cakes to your neighbors or whatever. But I agree 100% that we're really going to fail in any attempt to rejuvenate this country if we don't spend more time with our families and our phones and more time with our communities and even our phones, you know?
Yeah, when I was, a quick story, when I was in law school, I lived in the mountains above San Diego, and we had a little power outage that lasted all night, and it turned into a lovely experience because our little apartment community, it was a decent-sized apartment community.
Yeah.
Everyone was out there. It was hanging out in the kind of quad area, and, you know, I had my wife and two kids, and people were, like, sharing. Not that it would go this way if we actually experienced an EMP, but people were forced to share, and they were, like, telling stories.
Wow.
It was actually kind of amazing. So
wow.
I'm inclined to agree, you know?
And it's funny. Then you, without sounding like, I mean, I'm certainly the last person to sign on to the heresy of indifferentism, but, I mean, to find out you do have some things in common with people who are very different from you. And this is one thing I've noticed. I mean, I think I mentioned on one of these, I was on Taylor Marshall's thing that he aired today. I was like, the first half of my priesthood, I had no smartphone, no Facebook, no Twitter, no blog, no podcast. This is sort of just the result of, you know, my kind of life of wandering and covering random parishes and stuff that I've sort of picked this stuff up. But I noticed that, you know, when someone disagrees with me online, they say things they would never say to me in person. You know?
Right.
And it's like, if you're sitting on a fire above San Diego, and someone disagrees with you and it's 2 a.m, there's somehow you're going to work out a disagreement on even major issues of religion or politics, better than these keyboard warriors who will say hateful things, even the traditionalists talking to the traditionalists. That was our whole podcast today. But have you ever noticed that even when you're disagreeing with someone, if it's in person, there's always something more human about it?
Absolutely. It's the Dostoevsky quotation we're talking about. It is the Gran Torino thing. There's a quote where he's looking himself, Clint Eastwood, in the mirror, and he says, I have more in common with these blanks, using
yep.
a slur, than I
yep.
do with my own family. And
right.
he realizes that in just an afternoon of hanging out with him, somewhat, unwillingly at first, just an afternoon. And he says, wow, I have more in common with it. If that's not indifferentism or
mm-hmm.
syncretism or whatever, the differences which are there might remain. But
yeah.
there's when you spend time, this is what I tell people,
yeah.
spend time with people. I'm very pro-capitalism, right? But
mm-hmm.
capitalism just says, the government cannot legislate to force you to do or not do. It cannot force you to work 30 hours a week versus 60. It's up to you. But you should opt for less work if you can swing it, because then you get to spend time, relax, do fun things, pray, do some chores, or, you know, work in the garden with your family, you know, maybe have a slumber party out in the den one night. You need a whole range of activities among families.
Yeah,
and this is why being a teacher is so amazing, because in the summertime you really get this. Because
oh,
you can't
yeah.
force it all. What everyone notices about the two-day weekend is it's not, you have to pick, this will be my activity weekend and we'll be busy all weekend, or this is my chore weekend. It's so short that it's gone, it's fleeting. Or we're going to relax this weekend, but you don't accomplish anything, you feel bad at the end. You always end up feeling bad in a two-day weekend system. At the end, on Sundays, I always end up
yeah.
feeling like I misspent it, either too much activity or too little. And, you know, I have the kind of job, and this is why I left the law, frankly, is so
yeah.
I could spend more time with my family. That doesn't mean you blame capitalism. Capitalism gave me the freedom to decide, I only need this much money, and now I can work 30 hours a week instead of 60. That's essentially what a teacher does.
And I like what you say about people. Yeah, go ahead, keep going.
No, you got it.
Well, I just like what you say about time, because back to Gran Torino, this was in a planned topic for Tim and me, but it turns out we both like this movie. I think the character that most troubles me in that movie with Clint Eastwood is his granddaughter, because she could be a good person at heart, but she has no time for him. I think she's on her phone all the time. And then his surrogate granddaughter becomes that Hmong, am I saying that right? That's the Vietnamese culture, the girl
yeah.
next door. And it's precisely because she gives him her time, and this becomes basically his surrogate granddaughter and surrogate grandson, the kid who actually ends up inheriting the very name of the movie, the Gran Torino, that car. So these people that he calls Asian slurs end up becoming the ones closest to him precisely because they have the time for him, and his white grandkids and white son and white daughter-in-law do not have any time for him.
Yeah, his daughter-in-law really, yeah, that's a great point. His daughter-in-law really sticks out. The other aspect of the pro, you know, the anti-life culture, abortion mills, are the, I'm sorry to say it, the old folks' homes. You know, some of them are
absolutely,
but except I like the scene when his bougie, you know, daughter-in-law comes over and basically wants to get him. He's living alone. He's not a drain on anyone.
That's right.
He wants to get him out of his own house, presumably so that they could eventually take it and sell it or something.
Mm-hmm.
And she's not saying, hey, we want you out of this house. It's too big, too much for you, so come live with us, which would be loving and appropriate. She's saying, move out of your house where you have your autonomy and you enjoy it relatively still, and move into an old folks' home, which is, I mean, that's why I love the movie so much. It has a number of my points I care about, but they don't want to spend time with him. Old folks' homes too often represent the greed of capitalism. The greed of capitalism is not hard work or the lack of government interference in contract and property. That's socialist nonsense. The greed of capitalism is all on the part of the person that doesn't want to have an old person move in their home with them. So everyone that wants to condemn capitalism, look at yourself. Do you want to spend time with the people in your home? Are you willing to bring old, perhaps quote-unquote inconvenient persons into your home? That's the cycle of life. And the only way to build bonds, as Clint Eastwood learns in that movie, is just to not be completely busy all the time. And people are shocked that I make this critique from within a totally pro-capitalist framework. People have to individually choose to do this. You don't need the 6th TV. You don't need a super fancy car. It's priorities. And honestly, I feel like the baby boomers are the ones that gave us this expression, guys like me and you who are 38, 40.
Mm-hmm.
But except they're the ones that you don't have to work all the time. If you work a 60-hour work week, you will have time for nothing else. That's not capitalism's fault.
That's right. And I, even being so involved in the pro-life movement, I certainly don't have any problem with you saying the other end of the abortion issue is the old folks' homes, because, you know, we were kind of taught that this Terry Schiavo event that happened in Florida was this isolated event, but I've been shocked as a priest to be going into numerous hospices and nursing homes to find this is everywhere, this whole starving people is that. I had 3 cases of euthanasia as a priest in 1 month in my assignment in Florida last year. One of them, if you Google Father David Nix, Life Legal Defense Foundation, it was actually a 26-year-old Mexican from San Diego, actually, where he used to be, who was shot in the head, and then they transported him to Memorial Hospital in Jacksonville, resuscitated him, put him upstairs, wanted to harvest his organs, but, you know, as you know, they're going to cut the living heart, they're going to cut the heart out of a living person. Well, his parents are there, they're Spanish-only speaking, they're explaining that they want to wheel him away for his death without them there. Well, guess why they want to do that? It's so that they can cut the heart out of his living body, because a gunshot wound to the head hasn't actually harmed your cardiovascular system. Well, I spoke Spanish, and I intervened and explained what was going to happen, and so they said, no, we don't want that to happen. So we started to starve him to death. That's when I called Life Legal Defense Foundation. They got involved, got us a lawyer, got us a nasogastric tube and everything else, and ultimately he was able to die with some food getting put in his belly, with the sacraments, with his family around. But that was just one of 3 euthanasia events I had seen. The other two were a lot sadder because they were, one of the other two was an old person. They were starving to death at a hospital a few miles away from there. And this is I don't think most people out there either know this or want to know this, but almost, maybe I shouldn't say almost every, but I would say that most hospices of this country and some ICUs starve people either to death with no food and or they overdose them on narcotics. And so this isn't a rare event. This is happening in every state, every single day, coast to coast, euthanasias via a narcotics overdose or starvation to death. And some of the time I've actually intervened in this stuff. One was in Fort Collins, and it was kind of a really overweight trailer family that I came in on, and the grandpa was being starved to death by the nurse, and the nurse came in, and I said, you know, you really need to give him some food. And she couldn't believe she said this. She goes, I don't like Catholicism, and I don't like anything it stands for. And I thought, you know, if I were a rabbi, you'd go to prison for something like that. You know, I don't like Judaism, and I don't like Jews. Well, she'd go to prison for that. You know, but the thing is, I knew this family wasn't Catholic, so I was like, I have to take a different route for this. So I ended up saying, I turned to the family, and I just explained pathophysiologically what happens to a body when it starves and how painful of a death starvation is. It's a lot more painful than the cancer this man was dying for. And then, you know, this family turned to the nurse and said, we don't want our dad to die that way. So it had nothing to do with Catholicism. Starvation is an extremely horrible death, and it's happening coast to coast. People tell me even in Catholic hospices and stuff, I haven't seen that in Catholic hospices, but I've been told that. And so any listeners out there, I would definitely have durable power of attorney. Don't just have it written in your will, but have someone that you trust with bioethics to really be the person who's going to make these decisions for you on these things. How long are you going to be on a ventilator? Are you always going to have artificial nutrition and hydration? That's extremely important to have someone first line and second line, probably your spouse to be first line, but then if you both end up in an accident, also to have someone second line for those decisions.
Yeah, it's an unseen holocaust on par with abortion. I mean, abortion is the killing of the most innocent and the most defenseless.
And more.
Old people aren't the most innocent, but they are on par with the most defenseless. And I've been involved with situations where it turns ugly. People, all of a sudden, seemingly loving family members, you know, are not offering shelter to the elderly when they need it. It's a frightening prospect. And it's, again, people a lot of times would rather, like, oh, I'll pay monthly to this home. It's like, this person just needs your time and some of your care.
Part of the reason that his family's so distant from him is he didn't spend time with his son. Do you remember that?
Right. Yeah. He confesses it.
Yeah. That's right. He confesses it. I like that. You know, I like that priest that he was like straight. He was your typical like neoconservative Novus Ordo priest. Right. Clint Eastwood, like, I'm going to listen to a tubby virgin or something. Like, I can't remember how he puts it.
Yeah.
But it's like, and he had to really steel himself to stand up to him, but he did. He stood up. I mean, I really liked that priest because it was like he wasn't exactly sure himself, but he was sure enough of himself to stand up to him, and he made a convert of him, you know?
No, he did. He won.
Yeah.
No, he absolutely. He
right?
They could have gotten a less goofy-looking ginger or whatever, but
yeah.
It wouldn't have been. The point is, he
exactly.
Stood up, and Clint Eastwood invited him for a beer at the end. He won him
mm-hmm.
over.
Yep.
He's man enough for Clint Eastwood, and
yeah.
he gives that great eulogy. So he's a hero.
And ultimately, the best thing he gets out of him is his confession. The fact that he got a guy like that to go to confession by meeting him in a bar, standing up to him, I mean, that's awesome.
Right. It's true meeting him where he's at. It's not,
yes.
not just meeting him where he's at and letting him be this old curmudgeon, very typical
yeah.
of that generation, greatest generation. They don't think they owe a damn thing to anyone. They're like, I never went on welfare. I supported my family. It's like, yeah, but you raised a bunch of boomers, man, and this is why. They all acted like that.
And it's not accompaniment. That's right. What that priest does, it's not accompaniment like we keep hearing. It's, I don't know, surgery, something like that. It's like spending time with someone to ultimately bring him to Christ. But accompaniment is usually meant when people who say accompaniment just walk with them into nowhere land.
Well, it's the thing that happened with the so-called greatest generation is
yeah.
how they messed up all the baby boomers. Is
how? They didn't spend time with them?
They weren't spending time. Yeah, the baby boomers all have this messed up view of authority that it's just do as I say, and then in the 60s and 70s they revolted and did drugs and had sex.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
then they came, all these baby boomers in the 80s and 90s had their own families, and they came back around to what they thought they were wholly wrong and their parents were wholly right. Their dad was just
gotcha.
Like a buzz cut Johnny Unitas looking
right.
guy, as do as I say, even though they barely knew him.
Mm.
It's like, no, you have to do what they say. You know, the hippies were all wrong, but it's like,
yeah.
their
yeah.
dad didn't model how to do it because you never knew him. He didn't,
wow.
he didn't love you, didn't spend time with you. He just
wow.
earned money and he said that that's everything. So now you get these baby boomers that are 60, 65, and they think that you know, now they're no longer liberal, they're all conservative converts.
Mm-hmm.
But except
mm-hmm.
they never converted to religion or the sacraments or a father laying down his life for his family or even spending much time with his family and seeing him pray on his knees, for heaven's sakes.
Yeah.
People say to me again, you know, you're an incendiary fella, you're saying you're advocating openly for rebellion, you know, revolution,
mm-hmm.
you know, don't listen to the elder generations who led us into error, all that. And yet when it comes to honoring father and mother, Thomas Aquinas says it means one thing after the age of majority has been attained. It doesn't mean obey. I mean, don't obey your parents out there, kids, if you're listening, if they're telling you to mortal sin, which is a surprisingly common thing. But what you
sure.
must do in your old age is take care of them, even if they're the same people that were trying to lead you into error. You have to take care of them. Take them into your home, love them, and spend time with them.
Yeah.
It's key to rebuilding a meaningful republic is in the family and in neighborhoods and communities.
Beautiful. Well, Tim, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks a million. It's been great. I said, hi, it's great to be here, I was laughing at myself because I'm just in my own home on the land. Great to be on your radio waves.
Thanks for joining. We'll get you back on another time.
Thanks a million.
Say I can't tolerate you, 'cause your fee's too big.